Okay, so you start out as a farm boy.
Right.
Were you a first-generation farmer?
No. My father developed the land and farmed it ahead of me. So, yeah, my father came to Canada from England in 1903 as part of the Bar Colonist movement. Most of the people ended up settling at Lloydminster. And just a bit of history on that. I want to introduce my wife.
And I'm not being forward, I'm okay. Just being...
No, okay.
You were talking about the bar...
Yeah, my father came to Canada with the Bar Colonists, which was a settlement group from England that were headed for Lloydminster. During the trip, Mr. Barr disappeared, and the second in command was Reverend Lloyd. And so he took over the leadership of the group, and hence the name of the town, Lloydminster, which described Reverend Lloyd. However, my father never got to Lloydminster. He stopped off in Saskatoon and settled on a homestead at Maymont, Saskatchewan.
How's Maymont spelled?
M-A-Y-M-O-N-T.
Okay.
And that's where he started out as a 21-year-old farmer.
Was he involved in the initial pool movement?
Oh, yes, very much so. And he upgraded the farm to a very productive unit and also provided leadership in the community. So when the farmers became dissatisfied with the grain system the way it was at that time, he was a easy convert to the movement of doing something for farmers by themselves, and was one of the provisional leaders at the local level of the Saskatchewan Wheat Pool. And it was only natural when I came along and took over the farm that I too would be involved in the Saskatchewan Wheat Pool.
So when did you start to take a major role in the farm?
Well, in 1946, I guess, my brother and I, he was just freshly returned from overseas in the army. And we undertook to farm together, but he did not like farming, so he moved on. And I went to university, took agriculture, and then returned to the farm and got married in 1950. And together we took over the farm operations and stayed there until 1966 when we moved to Regina to assume office responsibilities with the pool.
Did your dad ever talk about why he felt a commitment to the co-op movement?
Well, he saw this as a way of farmers getting a square deal from elevator companies. And there's many horror stories about how farmers were treated in the early days. There was no end of elevator companies, up to 200 or something different elevator companies. I don't know the number now. And they simply exploited farmers. And so farmers got sick of it and said, okay, well, we'll organize ourselves and do it. And they did. So I know a lot of the major grain companies were resentful about the pools, but they brought it on themselves. Had they treated farmers with respect and fairly, there never would have been a wheat pool. So, but that is all history now.
Mm-hmm. But, we'll talk a bit more about that later on.
Okay, fine.
But I'm interested in your own history. So did you take over an interest in the wheat pool as well? Like, were you a delegate?
Yeah. So when Mel and I got married in 1950, we simply put all of our energy into developing the farm and upgrading it and that sort of thing. It was pretty good to start with, but we were making it better. And when I was at university, there was a professor there that absolutely extolled us to get back into our home communities and offer service, that we had a responsibility for leadership in our community, that we had the privilege of attending the university at taxpayers' expense, largely at taxpayers' expense. Of course, we paid tuition as well. And that, therefore, because we'd had that privilege, not everybody had, therefore we had the responsibility for leadership. And that rang a bell with me. I found that that wasn't challenging at all, because both of my parents had been leaders in the community, mother in the Homemakers Association and every community event, and dad in the municipality and in the wheat pool and so on. So I
do you remember the name of that professor? I think he deserves mention.
Yeah,
if you do.
Bill Baker was his name, and he was very forthright about this. And I know some people resented it, but I didn't. I took it as stimulation to do mm-hmm. exactly what he said.
What did they resent about it, do you think?
Well, I suppose nobody likes being told what they need to do. And we had, like my university class, I was extremely unfortunate in going to university in that at least a third of our class were veterans. They had served in the Second World War and they had come back. And because of their service, then their way to university was paid and that sort of thing. And we had this one third of our class, very mature people, some of them even into their 40s. And then there's a whole bunch of us young whippersnappers that that knew about our home communities, but we didn't know much about anything else. And so that was a tremendous education, just being around people like that. So I was very fortunate in that aspect of it.
Did you specialize at university?
No,
was there something,
no,
it's a generalist agriculture?
I just took the School of Agriculture, and then my only intent was to go back to the farm, which I did in 1948, and started to upgrade the farm.
So what changes were taking place in the farm at that time? You would have grown up on a farm,
yes,
when, I guess, horses were still...
Right. I remember driving horses in the field. I was pretty young, but I remember doing it. And then the mechanization for us started... well, we had a tractor all as long as I can remember, but because my father and his brother had bought a huge steam engine and thrashing machine, and they thrashed half the country up there. But chemicals were just coming in for weed control. Fertilizers were not commonly used. Technology was starting to descend on agriculture at that time, and mechanization was just going by leaps and bounds. And when I took over the farm, really in 1948. I was still in partnership with my brother, and then he decided to go off to other things. And then when I got married in 1950, well, I took over the management of the farm, even though my parents lived in the village close by and were partners with us. So we were faced with a whole lot of challenges, and we were living out on a snowbound farm in the winter and without electricity. So one of the first things I did when I came back from university was to organize the neighbors into applying for power, electrical power. And in those days, you had to do it in groups. And so Mel and I were the youngest in our community, in our little farm community, by a long way. And so, and the others seemed quite content for me to take leadership on this sort of thing. So Along with another young man in our community, I was able to organize to get power brought to our farm on the 31st of July, 1952. I'll never forget that day, because it flicking that switch changed our whole lifestyle dramatically. But at the same time, we were sick of driving horses in the winter, so I organized a snowplow club and bought a snowplow that I ran for 8 years. And as I say, the neighbors, they didn't seem to resent me sort of taking over leadership. They, in fact, they welcomed it, because
a lot of people were like to have leaders.
Yeah, well, they were
they're
older
willing
and
to,
they'd
to,
grown up with this, yeah. And they had never known different than that.
Yeah.
So and there I was keeping Bill Baker in the back of my mind about doing in the community. So I got involved in the community at the secretary of the Board of Trade and president of the curling club and so on and so forth.
Wow.
And baseball, avid baseball player.
And pool work? Like,
yes,
you,
about
you...
this time I you know, there was no doubt about my allegiance to the pool, but it wasn't because of first-hand experience. It was because of my respect for my father and what he had done in the leadership in the pool many years earlier. So of course, the wheat pool always held a local annual meeting every year, generally in the fall of the year. And when I hadn't gone to it, because we had to go to Saskatoon for a medical appointment of some kind. And when I came back, they said they'd put me on, I'd been elected to the Wheat Pool Committee. So, well, if you're going to be on something, you better either do it or not bother being on it. So we got involved there, and my interest started to grow. And suddenly, baseball and hockey and curling weren't as important to me as providing for the family, being a better farmer, and participation in community events. So it's kind of a remarkable change I felt inside. When I came back from university, I just wanted to be the best baseball player between Saskatoon and North Ballyburn. And I played a lot of baseball and really enjoyed it, and it was great fellowship and community and that. So then I got interested in the wheat pool, and suddenly somebody, the district field man, Don Sinclair, showed up in a bright September day and said, the wheat pool committee in Maymont want you to put your name forward for a delegate. And I said, oh, I can't do that. I haven't got time, da-da-da-da-da. I've got a small family. Just so happened that the neighbor from down the road was out in the field, because we were baling and we owned a baler together. I found out that by working together, you could do a lot of things. Like, I owned different machines with my neighbors and that to, you know, reduce the overall cost of them. And so this was all fitting into who I was and where I was. And so he said, no, don't worry, we'll make sure the work gets done. So I talked to Mel, and she said, well, I can see you're interested. Yes, go for it. And my father said, yeah, sure. He was anxious, actually, for me to be a delegate. So I said, okay, I'll take it on for 3 years. Well, 3 years stretched to 29. And
so that was about 1955 or so?
1957.
1957?
Yeah.
And you retired?
I retired from... from the wheat pool in 87,
yeah,
1987. So,
going in that early and having the background that your father had with it, how did issues change over the years related to the wheat pool?
Oh, well, of course, in the early days, they were just determined that they were going to get a fair price for their grain, and that was fine. That was the major objective. And in order to do that, they had to get an elevator system, because they had no elevators to start with. But and once they achieved that, then of course it was a matter of developing markets and putting up.
Now, where were we? Oh.
Well, the difference in the pool from the early days.
Right, and you were talking about they didn't have elevators.
Yeah, and then the pools went bankrupt with the stock market crash in 1929. The whole economy, of course, of the country was turned upside down. The pools weren't exempt from that. They went bankrupt. And but the provincial government, along with the major banks, agreed to keep the pool in business. And it was almost 20 years, I guess, before the debt was finally paid off. So that was the big challenges in the early pool. Then as the
When you first started as a delegate,
yes.
becoming involved, what were they
Yeah,
moving on?
we were pretty comfortable in the commercial operations. We were developing livestock marketing as more of a complete entity than what it was before. And I was very interested in that because I had livestock on the farm, particularly cattle. But the shift had taken place when you get at that time we had 164 delegates, and they would come together for a 2-week annual meeting in November, and there was countless committee meetings when you have a committee at every point in the province. I think at one time we had 1,200 country elevators, and we must have had about 1,250 wheat pool committees because some points had more than one committee. And when you get people meeting like that, they were passing resolutions in the country, and you get 160 plus farmers together, they're going to start putting forth policy demands. So we became a very important voice in public policy for agriculture, and that became almost a focus for us as I went through my tenure at the pool, 3 years as vice president and 18 years as president. And so I was involved as the chief spokesman of the organization for many of those years, for all the time as president.
Now, there are lots of policy issues, but as you think back on the time that you spent with the pool, what were sort of the major
The major issue always was the one that stands out above all others was net returns to farmers. And you know, there was an interesting chat in Chicago, from a university in Chicago that showed that on a net basis, taking into account relative inflation and that sort of thing, that the price of grain had never been higher than it was in 1918 or something of that nature. That isn't the exact date, but it showed that any increase in the actual price of grain was not relatively larger than it had been years earlier. And of course, the 30s were desperate when wheat was 10, 20 cents a bushel. But so our major concern was to get the net return for farmers. And of course, that meant railway costs and that, and the famous crow rate situation, and fighting to retain that crow rate, keeping elevator charges as low as we could. And of course, we were the largest grain company in Canada, and therefore we had a huge impact on what could be charged at that level. We took our we wanted one of the major issues, and even before I was there, was an international wheat agreement to bring stability to the world market. And we fought very hard for that, and never ever achieved it, but at least it had an impact and influence on what did happen internationally. So years later, I was in Geneva on several occasions negotiating grains agreements or wheat agreements with the various countries around the world. But always our concern was the net return to farmers. We'd been accused, and I suppose rightfully so, that we are concerned with the small farmer more than we were with the big farmer. Some use that as a weapon against us, but I always felt, well, the big farmers can look after themselves, but the other ones need to have the support of other farmers and the organization. So, but we had lots of big farmers in our membership as well. So,
couple of questions come out of that information. The international wheat agreements seem to be, if not annual negotiations, certainly frequent. What do you think over that period that you were aware of? Well, first of all, for those people who are listening who aren't aware, what difference does it make what other countries do?
Well, it makes a big difference on you, because if a company or a country just goes in and drops their price just to get rid of their product, then your price automatically comes down too. And what we sought when I was in Geneva was we wanted a floor price that was remunerative to farmers. And we were prepared to have a ceiling price that was fair to consumers, the purchasing nations. So when you go to negotiate an international wheat agreement, you have the two different factions there. You have the producing or exporting countries, and you have the importing countries. And not always was it complete agreement in the exporting countries, because I used to get into lots of verbal battles with my American friends who felt that if we, big countries like Canada and the United States, dropped our price, we could force a lot of the smaller producing countries out of business, and therefore we'd have the market to ourselves. But I personally, I couldn't go along with that. I didn't think that was the way to go. But it was a huge, we could talk for hours on the philosophies in grains arrangements and that sort of thing.
Were there natural allies with Canada's position?
Generally, Australia was closely aligned with us most often. Argentine was in and out, depending on how much grain they had in their bins. Sometimes they really wanted an agreement, and other times they didn't want any at all. But Canada and the United States and Australia for sure, and oftentimes with the Americans too.
Because now you can look back on all of the years that you were aware of what was going on and in many instances actively involved. Do you think anything was accomplished?
Oh, I think so. I think we.
How would you describe the accomplishments?
I think we brought stability to. To the international market, not as formally structured as what we were seeking, but nevertheless, it increased an awareness of the things we were talking about, and even countries like Japan that said they didn't want an international wheat agreement, they didn't want to get stuck in a short market either, where people were exploiting them. They were quite happy when there was a world surplus and they could play one off against the other. And as I described to the Japanese at an International Federation of Agriculture meeting one time, that my wife had owned a succession of Toyota cars, and each one cost me, I think the first one I had to spend 1,200 bushels of wheat to get that. The next one was 3,600, and the next one was 7,200 bushels of wheat to buy almost the equivalent car, with upgrades, of course. And the Japanese didn't really have an answer for that, because they were talking about we were exploiting them and all this sort of thing. So purchasing power isn't always dollars. Sometimes it's a commodity of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. And so these were huge, huge battles that we used to have.
Coming out of the agreements, were they usually signed?
Oh yes, yeah. You would sign if, or we came home from Geneva on a couple of occasions without any signatures, because we just couldn't. I was confronted when we came back one time by the press and said, "Well, you know, why didn't you get an agreement, a signed agreement?" And I said, "Well, I don't need an international agreement to give me a lousy price. The market will do that any day."
And having been signed, were they always?
Yeah, there was. No, there was times, you know, but there was the International Wheat Council that oversaw this and was a disciplinary body there. But there was violations to the agreement from time to time, but they weren't. Most people stuck with them, or close to them, anyway.
If you were speaking to a group of farmers, how would you describe to them the impact of having and not having an international agreement?
Well, just as I've tried to express here, and I did this on countless platforms, stability. Yeah.
It's important.
They knew that they were going to get a minimum of, let's say, $2.50 a bushel for their grain, and they could, then their challenge was production. You know, of course it always was production anyway, but then they could start to organize, manage their resources better. If they weren't sure when they went to the field in the spring if the price was going to be $5 or $1, you know, that is a challenge then. How much do I put into fertilizer, or how much do I put into sprays, and what do I grow, and this sort of thing. So I think that we were able to bring some stability into the market through all of this. No, I'm talking like I'm the only one. That's not
no,
the
case.
No,
I understand as a,
like
part of the Canadian delegation.
President of Alberta Pool and Manitoba Pool were always there, and United Grain Growers and so on. Mm-hmm. And so we were there as advisors to the Canadian government on this, and some of us played a little stronger role, maybe because of the size of our companies or whatever, I don't know.
You mentioned railway costs. From my reading of the papers, that has ever been the situation.
Sure. Yes, it has, and it's we had a very favorable grain rate because of the Crow's Nest Pass Agreement that set the rate for grain moving from the prairies to export position, and actually it. It was set for Canadian National moving grain, I think, from the prairies to Thunder Bay. But then it was extended to Canadian Pacific and also for both railways to the West Coast at the same half a cent per bushel per mile or something like that. And that's way too high. But anyway, it stabilized us at a very low level. But interestingly enough, it only made us competitive with the United States and Australia and Argentina, because the United States had at least as highly subsidized rate through their waterway system, which was completely funded and maintained by the federal government through different agencies. Australia, all of its wheat production is within 300 or 400 miles of tidewater. Argentine is the same, very close to tidewater wherever. And so they had a huge geographical advantage over Canada. So our crow rate gave us the ability to be competitive at the international level on grain shipments.
So it must have been interesting times at the wheat pool, delegates discussing the eventually elimination of it.
It was, and I was the president during those years and got beat up on pretty good. But we got to the point where the railway said they simply had no more money to put into rail services. There was a long history of intervention from provincial governments, the federal government, the wheat board, all buying grain cars, and this had run its course, and the railway said, "Well, we just can't do it. We're not getting enough revenue out of grain to make the investment," and so we had to come face the reality that what do we want? Do we want to maintain the grain rate and not have any movement, or do we want to pay some more and get our product to market? It was a long, spirited debate in our annual meeting, but we finally made the decision that we would negotiate under certain terms the change in the grain rate, and we went on and did that.
Do you recall approximately when that was and how many years, like, was it done at a certain point in your career that you could see the fallout from it and whether it accomplished what you had hoped it would?
Well, certainly it the railways responded good at the time with the upgrading. I think it was 1982 when we had the big negotiations on that. And we got a pretty good deal, I thought, for farmers on it. But then I can't even think of all the details now. I'd have to go to my notes. But essentially, the government said if the farmers will pay an increased rate, we will commit $650 million towards the overall costs, the railway costs. And of course, as users of the system and representing farmers, we wanted to make sure that the railway costs were legitimate, that they weren't saying suddenly, okay, this is our costs, government give us $650 million, farmers you give us the rest. And of course, farmers and even large companies like Saskatchewan Wheat Pool was at that time simply didn't have access to or the resources to understand railway accounting. Only the federal government had that ability to do that. So that was one of the weaknesses in our plan, is that the government gave us a finite amount, and then the railways could determine the difference, and being better off if they had charged us a definite amount and then the government be responsible for the difference, but didn't work that way. And then, but it was a good deal, and then the federal government, after my time, offered farmers a certain amount of money to buy them out, and then they'd be responsible for the full costs after that. I thought that was a shame, because the government sure knew what they were doing, and they got off the hook pretty lightly and transferred it all to farmers. So. Mm.
I'd like to talk to you, because we do have a limited time, and because you're so knowledgeable, I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about Saskatchewan Wheat Pools terminal elevators.
Sure.
We might be able to come back to other things as
okay,
well, but
fine.
I don't want to miss this because we have a special focus on terminal elevators.
Oh, okay, good for you.
So the only thing I know about Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan Cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with. The only thing I know about Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal Saskatchewan terminal elevators pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevator. The only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the Saskatchewan cooperative elevators, which the only thing I know about terminal, Saskatchewan terminal elevators, pretty much has to do with the only thing I know about.
We had planned this whole thing, and there was no way that we could really justify the expenditure. The economics just were not there. And so we approached the Federal Minister of Agriculture and asked for permission to put on a surcharge of, what was the surcharge? It wasn't huge.
That can be checked.
$2.50 a ton or something like that, which would flip it over and we would be economical. And he said, sure, go ahead, because the governments, particularly the Alberta government, desperately wanted that Prince Rupert Terminal, and they provided money and leadership and that sort of thing. Even the Hugh Horner, who I think was Deputy Premier of Alberta at the time, came on the board of Prince Rupert to protect their government's interests in that. Then the Federal Minister of Agriculture, because he got a half a dozen letters from the rural areas protesting this surcharge, he said, no, he won't go ahead with it. And it was so easily justifiable because the shipping costs from Prince Rupert to Japan were $2.50 a ton cheaper than they were out of Vancouver. So the farmers were breaking even on this, even with the additional charge. And it allowed a efficient or a viable operation.
Yeah, not not as congested as I imagine they talk about the Port of Vancouver.
Well, it gave us huge capacity, and we were fighting for capacity to the West Coast, through the West Coast.
Yeah. And so it would have been that time that, and this would have been after the Russian grain deal, that things started to really shift from east.
Yeah, the shift was on really, although we didn't recognize it, following the Second World War, when Europe made the decision that they would never again be short of food, because Europe almost starved to death during that war. So they instituted their common agriculture policy that had huge subsidies for production, agriculture production, huge subsidies for storing of surplus production. And essentially, Europe became close to self-sufficient in grain products, and that had been one of our big markets. That's why Thunder Bay, that's why Churchill was important. That's why those transfer elevators in the St. Lawrence were so important to us. Well, when Europe started falling off on their demand, thank goodness for Canadian farmers, the demand in China and Japan and all over the East, Far East rose. But it was not good news for Thunder Bay, because it meant flip-flop in grain. Now, at one time, there was only a few bushels of grain went from Manitoba to the Pacific. Everything went to Thunder Bay. There was only a small portion of the Saskatchewan crop that would be west of Broadview that went to east of Broadview, that would go to the Pacific. So, but then as that changed, then they started reaching further and further east and cutting into Thunder Bay territory. So that was a tough one, and there was lots of battles to increase understanding about that.
Why was it difficult? It seems fairly straightforward.
Well, it was so difficult for Thunder Bay, you know, and for companies with their big investments there too. And the members of the Chamber of Maritime Commerce did not understand what was happening in this whole area. And they were told that simply all you had to do was, we had a huge political debate for years about the what we called the method of payment of the Crow benefit. Some were advocating that it be paid to farmers. We were advocating it be paid to the railways directly by the government, because only government could regulate the railways. Individual farmers could not. If it was a subsidy paid to farmers, then we get into international negotiations that gets targeted right off the bat, and it's gone. And we had this, but the people at Thunder Bay were convinced that if it were paid to farmers, suddenly they'd start coming to Thunder Bay. Well, I said, you know, you guys be careful what you wish for, because it's not going to happen. That's not what determines whether they come to Thunder Bay or not, whether they have the freedom or where they're going to spend this newfound money. I had huge talks within the Chamber of Maritime Commerce about that. But they were convinced that if the farmers were paid directly the Crow subsidy, then Thunder Bay would...
And who were the theys? The ship owners?
Yeah, the head of the Dominion Marine Association, who was also the head of the Chamber of Maritime Commerce, a guy by the name of Norman Hall, and he and I actually fell out over that particular item. And he was representing shipping interests as well as the Great Lakes Development Association. So, but that's a long and complicated story. So, but anyway, it wasn't any internal factors in Canada. It was simply the external factors, largely the common agriculture policy of the European Economic Community.
I'm going to move on because we're heading into our last 45 minutes, and I want to talk about your experience in Saskatchewan wheat pool and dealing with the Canadian Grain Commission.
The Canadian Grain Commission?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was no problem at all. We had a positive relationship with the Grain Commission and supported very much the things they were doing.
Anything get your goat?
Oh, I suppose there was, but you know, we used to battle with them about they really controlled the grain rates that you could charge, how much you could charge for storage, how much you could charge for handling it at all, both country and terminal elevators. We used to battle with them on that, but it was never a major issue.
Just the usual cut and thrust of negotiating a price.
Sure, they were doing their job protecting farmers, and we generally had our commercial hats on at that time, wanting to get a few extra dollars in the commercial system. But we had no problem there.
Now, how did that work? Because the farmers owned the wheat pool,
right?
And owned the elevators, and yet they were charging farmers. So how does that work out?
We charge farmers the standard fee for handling their grain, for storing their grain, cleaning it, or whatever we did. And then at the end of the year, we totaled up everything, and if there was something left over, we returned it to the farmers.
So how does higher rates for handling, that doesn't just sort of come out in the wash?
Well,
because they would be getting the profit from the higher rates?
It would within the cooperatives, but then there was, that other sector that wasn't within the cooperative sector too, so... we didn't want to charge more than what was necessary to keep the system viable. Mm. And so the other companies didn't like us very much because we generally proposed lower rates than what the other companies in the negotiation with the Canadian Grain Commission. So
because of volume, essentially?
Yeah, we had a volume advantage. I don't recall any great concerns with the Grain Commission.
Canadian Wheat Board.
Well, we had a long and very positive relationship with the Wheat Board. Had our usual battles with them about car allocation and things like that. But there's a certificate in the office there that showed that I had 13 years as an advisor to the Canadian Wheat Board. So we were pretty well attuned with them. I went with them on occasion to overseas functions to promote Canadian grain and that. Never on negotiating sessions, but we had a common philosophy about getting the best price for farmers out of all of this. I don't have much to add to that, Nancy.
You mentioned that because of the work you did, you were involved in the marine side of things too. What kind of setup was there at Saskatchewan Wheat Pool for dealing with water shipment?
Well, we had to negotiate with shippers on that.
Did you have a division, like a shippers division?
No, it was handled through our terminal division. So
okay.
I think they had people assigned to that.
So Mr. McDonald would know that?
McDonald would certainly know that, yeah. And so, like, how I got to be involved with the Great Lakes Waterways Development Association is that there were numerous, I don't know, hundreds of members of that association, like towns and cities all along the Great Lakes and the waterways and that, and the grain companies and the railways and so on. And when it came to the grain industry, the fee that was paid related to the volume that was done. So, as it turned out, Saskatchewan Wheat Pool paid the largest fee of anybody into the Great Lakes Waterways Association. We had, you know, huge volumes through Thunder Bay. And so after I had retired from the Wheat Pool, they asked me to take on the chairmanship of that, so I did. And so that's how I got involved there. And as I say, I don't know if the Chamber of Maritime Commerce still exists or not. I have no idea. I've been away from it, so that my last contact with that would be 1989, I guess. So. So
what did you learn about maritime shipping as a result of being on that?
Well, our big focus in that was working with the government agency that controlled the shipping, you know, the opening of the canals, the opening of the seaway and the canals each year, and that was very crucial to elevator companies. Not only the exact date, but to know the exact date ahead of time, that be so, you know, when they're going to close it down on the 23rd of December or the 18th or whatever, and then when does it open, the 4th of April or, you know, sometime in March, and then we spent quite a bit of time talking about the locks and the need to upgrade the locks and. I recall being down in the bottom of one of those locks in December one year, or January, I guess it was. December is still operating. Down near Thorold, Ontario. So we did an awful lot of work with that. And then really, it was a surprise to me when we got into this debate on the how the farmers or how the crow benefit would be distributed. I thought that was right out of off base for this Chamber of Maritime Commerce, but others insisted it was part of it, so I had to take a contrary view because that's where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. And
well, I guess they saw their responsibility keeping or improving shipments.
Yeah, and there was an organization, Thunder Bay.
The Port Authority?
Port Authority, yeah. They were very, very vocal on this, and they were convinced of this. And so, anyway, that was in the public policy area.
Yeah. Sort of have my own conclusions relative to the shipments out of Thunder Bay. I like yours. Was there anything that Thunder Bay could have done differently to stop the shift of
migration? Well, I don't think so. When you look at it, there's no way you're going to service Japan out of Thunder Bay. Just no way. You know, it's absolutely marvelous having a port, sea-going port, in the center of a continent. But that road from the port to tidewater, you know, it had a lot of obstacles in it. And
charges.
Yeah, you know, when you got to use locks and locks and so on, and you're limited to the size of ships. You know, it's getting so, what was it, 35,000 tons? Is that the limit? Maybe it's a little larger. Competing with, you know, 1 million tons or whatever they carry now. It was a marvel, actually, but the world passed it by, actually. And I don't know what you could have done in Thunder Bay unless you put in all new lock system, which horrendous, you know, and not only the length of the lock, but the width of the lock. And, you know, once you get to the St. Lawrence, then I think there wasn't any obstacles there that I understood to interfere much.
I want to move on to talk about a couple of things. One being, I've chatted with Wally and Ray and Devlet Livingstone and so on about
yes.
what happened in the co-op or in the pool system over the years that led to the eventual demise of the pools.
Well, if you get that figured out, tell me, because I don't know. It turned they turned away somewhere from this objective of farmers first, and you know, I've been bewildered about how the organization disappeared.
Did it? Were there indications of shifts in attitudes even among the farmers before 1989? Was it when you left?
Oh, sure. And we were accommodating those. You know, we were bringing a number of elevator points down dramatically. Although I suppose interpretation of dramatically might vary. But as I say, we had one time 1,200 country elevator points. And we had reduced that, I think when I left the pool in 1987, when I left in January, 89 was when I left the three pools. We were down to around 700 elevator points. But we did this by reducing, but then upgrading an adjacent point to give better service. And farmers hated losing their local elevator point. And some didn't even use it, and yet they were very upset about it because it was their community. They could see it as a weakening of community. But at the same time, their trucks were getting larger and their ability to travel farther was greater and that. The system was built for horse and wagon, when you realize it. And we had lots of anxious meetings out in the country, but for the most part, the changes, the consolidation was being accepted. And we had told the farmers through our delegates and that our objective was to go to 350 elevator points across the province, and that we expected to be at 400 by 1990 or something like that. We had set out a timeline for them, because that's not much different
right.
than this.
We were talking about the changes that the pool went through over time, and then the big
right.
sort of almost like a I think there's some business term for the kind of shift that happened a few years back. Were you involved at all in any of the negotiations for the pools combining?
No.
So that started after?
That was after I left, actually.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be, but then it didn't materialize, and so
And it wasn't successful. And well, it was successful for two.
Yeah, it came almost to... I've been told by one of the people that was in the negotiations that they'd actually reached agreement, and then Sasquatch bowed out at the next meeting. So so that was the end of it. So Manitoba and Alberta actually went together. And
Do you think that would have been, and you were looking at from the outside, would that have been the answer to it?
It would have answered a lot of the questions that were situations that have arisen since. So. No, I was very disappointed when they didn't bring about the amalgamation. So there was great synergy in that.
Do you think that story will ever be told?
I don't know. I can't tell it because
I
don't know it.
You don't know it.
No.
Yeah. The Canadian Wheat Board. You've mentioned because you know. Their stated goal was to get the best price for farmers. It was a real synergy between them and Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, which had the same the same goals. We've talked about the railways, the handlers. If you think about Canada's history as a grain trader, and you mentioned yourself a couple of times just how far the wheat producing area is from the ports and markets, what do you think made Canada successful in spite of geography, climate?
High quality. We produced wheat like few other areas in the world could produce in as far as quality, strong gluten content, excellent baking qualities. Between the Grain Commission ensured absolute cleanliness in the shipments that left the country. So the importers weren't paying for weed seeds or anything like that. You know, the ability of our farmers to produce this high quality in the quantities that were required, the system ensuring weights, cleanliness, the system really supported it as well. Our transportation system, which included ships on the Great Lakes and the occasional oversea or high sea vessel. We got established into the world markets on that basis, and we were by far the leading exporter of milling wheat until the United States decided to go into it in a big way following the First World War, too. They had, during their wartime, you know, put on extra efforts to encourage production and that sort of thing. And then they ended, after the war, they had a huge surplus, much more than the American people could consume. So they decided to blast their way into world markets, and they did so with export subsidies. They did so ensured production by subsidizing producers, and so that dropped Canada out of the number one spot of export for milling wheat. And it was tough to take to hear countries like the United States complain about our crow rate subsidy when they had massive subsidies, not only in their waterways, but also in production subsidies that they were trying to hide from the rest of the world. They had Public Law 480 that ensured producers got subsidies. It ensured export subsidies when required, It ensured or it allowed the United States to go into countries and exchange wheat for strategic military sites. There was another clause in there, I can't remember what it was. But I used the word blasted, and that's what they did, blasted their way into the world markets.
When I hear you talk about that, and I've heard others involved speak of that as well, how can you have successful negotiations when a pretty major player is
not
playing fair?
No, that was always there, and it was tough to negotiate, virtually impossible on occasions to negotiate under those circumstances. Right up to the time of the Canada-North America Free Trade Agreement, which I sat in on that, and a good chunk of it. And
did you feel that was going to be a good deal for farmers?
We did a good job of laying out the agriculture objectives of what we had to achieve there. And so, no, I never saw that as a good deal for farmers. It was good. It was more for our manufacturing sector, which was a good deal for farmers because it allowed a stronger economy in other parts of the country, which benefits agriculture too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. But not directly.
No, you can't take a narrow view on these things
yeah.
because if you do, you miss out on opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So, no.
That's a good philosophy.
Big pardon?
I say that's a good philosophy.
Well, so I had no problem fitting in on the, as an advisor to the development of our free trade agreement.
Mm.
And
Do you have any thoughts on the sort of almost the co-demise of the Canadian Wheat Board? And the wheat pools, and what farmers might gain or lose
yeah.
from that.
Well, of course, I'm completely biased, and I don't mind admitting so in regard to both the wheat pool and the wheat board. I saw those as tremendously valuable assets for farmers, and but. I don't know why farmers seem to lose some interest, although I wasn't around at the time, in maintaining these entities. But at the time of the debate, the political debate about the wheat board, there was no lack of farmer interest in that, and they were very, very strongly in favor of retaining the wheat board. And otherwise, if it had been the other way, we'd have had a vote on it to prove that the government was right. The government was terrified of a vote to keep the wheat board because they knew it would fail dramatically to change the wheat board. And I don't think the whole story's been told in regard to the wheat board yet. The change was made at a very fortunate time for farmers, and that the United States had a huge crop failure. They weren't really strong competitors in the international market. We had a very good crop, and because of the shortages in other places, the prices were strong. There was no conflict in or competition in marketing. But if those things happen to reverse, then I think people will be looking to see, well, what went wrong here. So, but I say I'm completely biased and a bit of an old dinosaur, no doubt. So,
The size of farms now is quite different too.
It's dramatically
so,
different. Yeah.
So the whole has not the whole farming scene.
Yeah,
just
the whole farming scene
changed.
Is well as these comfort organizations disappear, then a lot of farmers are just willing to say, okay, well, I don't want to do this anymore.
What do you mean, comfort organization?
Well, Sask Wheat Pool, or the Wheat Pools, rather, and the Canadian Wheat Board. A lot of farmers didn't want to get into that game of should I sell today or tomorrow? Should I sell ahead? You know, what should I hedge and what shouldn't I? And they didn't want to get into that, and yet they knew they were going to have to. They knew the wheat pools were there for their benefit. They could trust us. And so I think there's going to be some interesting revelations come to farmers before all of this is over.
Yeah. And mostly, interesting, use the term interesting, because that's what most people, and whether you come on what side you come down on, they said it will be interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. When you look back on your career, I'd like to mention that lots of people on tape have spoken very highly of your time in the grain business. What brings you the most satisfaction? What are you most proud of?
Well, I think right up till the time I left Saskatchewan Wheat Pool and left the three pools, I feel good about my service to farmers and protecting their interests to the best of my ability. And that was my sole goal in life, in my career, to do that. And of course, lots of people argue I didn't do a very good job, so I guess that's up to their decision. But I feel good about my complete honesty with farmers. I never misled them. I told them their elevator system had to get smaller when it had to get smaller. I told them the grain rate had to change whether we liked it or not if we were going to continue to have a transportation system. Some will still argue that I was wrong on that. But I guess I feel like I'm through all of this with a great deal of integrity. I've never deliberately misled people, except on the federal purchase when we couldn't say anything.
That's hard to do, isn't it, when you tend to be the kind of person who wants to.
One of our directors said
stories.
I had to lie for the first time in my life when somebody asked me if we were in talks with federal grain. And we couldn't dare say anything because of the public trading of federal grain. So.
Mm-hmm. Anything you would have done differently?
Oh, I'm sure there was a thousand things probably.
But nothing you lose over. I mean, there's always good of the hindsight, right?
Yeah. I don't really know, and that maybe sounds conceited to say that, but I followed the tasks that I was given to do in the various roles in the wheat pool. And I looked at it always as bigger than the wheat pool. I looked at it as roles in agriculture. And then later on, roles in Canada, as I consulted in the trade talks, and I was at the kickoff of GATT in Uruguay and the last GATT negotiating session. And so I felt I had a bit of service to the country beyond even agriculture, because we talked about a lot of things in the GATT discussions. Now, I was there for agriculture, but there was a lot of other consideration. So I followed the tasks I agreed to undertake, and I followed my own personal philosophy, and I don't think I compromised my ethics or integrity along the way. Not intentionally, I didn't, anyway.
Any questions I should have asked you that I haven't?
You didn't ask my age.
I thought I would be sort of sneaky about that and see, you went into farming. So when were you born?
1927. So
1927.
That might be a clue.
Um, Any other people you feel, we're winding down the project,
okay.
So
well,
you feel besides Mr. McDonald that you'll try to...
I don't have his number, I don't think. I would phone him right now if I did have.
I might be able to send you what I've got.
Okay.
And anyway...
Have you got his number?
I think I have it somewhere. I'll have to check. There's my information if you track him down before I get back to you.
There is.
Oh, good. Thank you. I have another question to ask you, but I will ask that once I shut us off here. So thank you very much for fitting me in at late notice into your very busy schedule.
Yeah.
Would you like to say goodbye to your listeners?
Well, certainly. This has been a delight talking about myself.
Good.
But with such a delightful interviewer.
Thank you. Bye-bye.